Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. A lot of people say that they'd like to spend their retirement years writing, but Dr. June Hall McCash actually does it. The former director of the MTSU Honors Program and professor emerita in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures was named Georgia Author of the Year for her 2011 novel, Almost to Eden. Her nonfiction book, A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss, chronicled the history of a couple whose love outlasted one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. In her latest novel, Plum Orchard, McCash returns to Georgia, Cumberland Island specifically, for the story of a woman born to a white plantation father and a slave mother, raised in the white world but not fitting in either white or black life. June Hall McCash talks about Plum Orchard after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The MTSU Student Food Pantry is in critical need of supplies this spring to ensure that every MTSU student in need is able to have at least one meal a day. To donate food, contact Becca Sewell at 615-494-8910, or visit the pantry's website at mtsu.edu/foodpantry. World-renowned trumpet soloist Jens Lindemann will join the MTSU Wind Ensemble for a special concert on Thursday, April 18th in the Hinton Music Hall of the Wright Music Building. The free performance is set for 7:30 p.m. and is open to the public. And finally, MTSU's Collage, a journal of creative expression, continues to excel against peer publications in national competitions. Collage recently earned a Collegiate Gold Crown Award from the Columbia Scholastic Press Association for the second straight year, making it the third major award in the past 3 years. And for MTSU News Anytime, go to mtsunews.com.
June, welcome back. It's good to have you again.
Well, thank you, Jenna. It's very nice to be here.
Now, we know that slave masters had children with their slave women. That's pretty fairly well known, but these slaves in your book, Plum Orchard, speak French. So let's start out talking about the people who inhabit Cumberland Island during this time period and their culture and how the white culture and the black culture intermingled.
Well, the particular family that I write about began their life in Georgia on Jekyll Island. Actually, the woman in my book was born on Jekyll Island, which, as you know, I've written about extensively.
And now is a great resort area, great tourism area.
That's right. And when she was 4 years old, she and her family moved to Cumberland Island and bought a plantation called Plum Orchard. Her father, whose name was Pierre Bernardi, he was French. And her grandmother lived with her as well. And her mother was Pierre Bernardi's slave. And Zabette, as she was called, her name was Elizabeth, but Zabette is a very common nickname for Elizabeth in French. And she was raised by her white grandmother. Her father died when she was relatively young, but she grew up speaking French, as did many of the slaves in that particular family, in that particular plantation. But they had their own language as well, as you know, as you probably know, that archaeologists and linguists have kind of linked them together and called them Gullah Geechee, although Gullah is technically South Carolina language, a South Carolina island language, whereas Geechee was the Georgia version. But I think today they're being pretty much treated as a unit. Mm-hmm. Zabette would probably have understood both languages, and of course she would have to have known English as well. So she grew up virtually trilingual, which is rather unusual in those days. But her father died when she was very young, and she was raised by her grandmother in a white household. In fact, I tried very hard to work this into the book, but sometimes you just have to leave out some of those tiny tidbits of information mm-hmm. that you actually know, because this, as you know, is a historical novel.
Right.
Her story is true. But a census taker did come to Cumberland Island and take her for a white girl. when she was a child.
So she was light-skinned enough to pass.
Presumably, well, that's questionable whether she would have passed among
strangers.
Strangers, but presumably her skin was very light. And, of course, her children did pass. Her children, one of her children married a Russian count, one of her daughters, and one of her her other daughters did marry white men. One of them had a little blonde child. I have a photograph of him. So it was not surprising that they would have been very, very light-skinned. And Zabet grew up in that white world, but she didn't really belong there, as other planters in the area would have known who her mother was. But she didn't really belong in the what they call the quarters either, with the African Americans who lived there, because she had not been reared in that particular culture either. So she really didn't fit in anywhere. Mm-hmm. It was a very must have been a very difficult childhood for her. Mm-hmm. And as she grew to be a young woman, as you see in the book, there weren't many options open to her.
Right. What happened to Zabet's mother, Marie Jeanne.
In fact, some of the slave records spell it Marie, J-O-H-N, but the French name was J-E-A-N-N-E, Marie Jeanne.
Right, which some of us pronounce Jeannie in America.
Right. Yeah. We don't really know what ultimately happened to her in my book. She does remain on the plantation. There is a time in which she is separated from her daughter by the father, and presumably that was true because she was raised in the white household and not in the slave quarters. But presumably Marie-Jeanne, I know she remained on the plantation for a very long time because she is part of the division of slaves after Pierre Bernardi's death. And I used even though it's a historical novel, therefore historical fiction, I did use the plantation records, and I used the names of the people who were enslaved on that island as my characters in my book.
The deathbed scene with Pierre, her father, Zabet's father, is very touching. It's almost as though he didn't realize what he had until he was about to shuffle off this mortal coil.
You mean her mother?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted Zabet to be born of a love relationship. And although after she was born, he did marry. He could never have married her mother. The laws of Georgia, of course, would have prohibited that, as it would have prohibited Zabet from marrying a white man in her later life. But I do feel that, because he had two children by her, you know, and right. I feel that there must have been some affection there, although those relationships can also be very brutal. And I tended to, up to a point at least, to put the best face on it, but at the moment of jealousy in the book, you see what happens. He becomes very brutal and very unkind to her. And of course, as a slave master, he would have had that legal right, although I think not a moral right, to do what he did.
Mm-hmm. We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record in just a moment.
The Tennessee Early Childhood Training Alliance, or TECTA, works to improve the quality of child care in Tennessee by establishing a statewide training and professional recognition system. Through TECTA, child care providers may be eligible for free orientation training, tuition support for early childhood academic courses, and networking opportunities, as well as other services. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the historical novel Plum Orchard with its author, Dr. June Hall McCash, former director of the MTSU Honors Program. There's a scene in the book where a drunken slave named William tries to take advantage of Marie-Jeanne, and Pierre blames her for it instead of blaming William, even though he was crazy drunk and she was attempting to resist. What's up with that?
Well, I don't think that such events would have been that different in the white community. I think frequently women are held accountable for such illicit relationships that men were just as involved in and perhaps instigated in those days particularly. We're talking the 1820s, 1830s in this era. And men, of course, whether white or black, certainly had certain powers over women. And William, in this book, William is just a boy. It's his first time he's ever been drunk, and he's attracted to Marie-Jeanne because she's very beautiful. And yet she does try to resist, and her little girl calls out, "Papa." And, of course, she's never allowed to call her father that. Right. Unless they're alone, but it's the middle of the night, and she wakes him up, and they're in different homes. She's been sleeping with her mother in the cook's cabin behind the house, but he wakes up and comes down and sees what's going on and immediately holds her responsible, although it's William he beats. He whips William brutally.
Yes.
And certainly holds him accountable to some extent, but he is so enraged with her that he calls her some very ugly names and banishes her from the household and separates her from her daughter.
The way in which you describe that scene, the way in which you have written it, it manages to convey all of the brutality and cruelty, because not only William's brutality and cruelty, but it reminds us that whites having sex with black slaves is, for all intents and purposes, rape, because one is in a subservient position where the woman cannot do anything to extricate herself from the situation socially, legally, or any other way. You don't use harsh language, the kind of vulgar, harsh language that could be used to describe a scene like that and really drive home its horror. Were you conscious of walking a tightrope when you were trying to describe that kind of scene, of trying to be explicit without going over the line?
Absolutely. I want to write books that I don't feel ashamed for my grandchildren to read, you know, and they do. Some of them do read my books. But I do occasionally have scenes that are perhaps, I think, very brutal. I mean, I think the one word he uses to call her by a name is the French word putain, and it means basically whore. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say it but once in my book, but once is sufficient. I think frequently when you overuse language, you can weaken it, that when you find one word or just a few hints of this kind of language, it sometimes carries more impact in a novel that's really written for an audience that is not accustomed to using these words every day.
Right.
That it has certain power.
And at the same time, since it's a historical novel, you are, of course, concerned with historical accuracy.
Exactly. And, of course, people in the 19th century, at least here, did not always talk the same way we do. They did use words we wouldn't use today, and I've very again used those words, but very, very sparingly, because, well, for obvious reasons. I had one African American friend who read my book. I wanted to get her reaction before I published it, and she said to me, as I said, "Well, was it too harsh? Was there too much?" In terms of the beating of the slaves and that kind of thing. And she said to me, "June, you don't want to make slavery look too nice." And I thought, absolutely.
Right.
And as a consequence, I left those scenes in because they are part of that life. They're historically accurate. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any second thoughts about writing in dialect?
I certainly did. And today the tendency is to downplay dialect. And there's one scene at the end after Pierre's funeral in which I have the African Americans sitting in the quarters and talking about what the future is for them. And I debated back and forth. You know how in dialect sometimes you will, in African American dialect of the islands, you'll use the D instead of the TH. I went back and forth and probably wrote that scene 5 or 6 times. I finally ended up not using the D. I'm still not sure I made the right decision. But I did. I tried very hard to give you the flavor of the language through syntax, and word choice rather than by artificial spellings and that sort of thing. And I did, there was, because of the Gullah Geechee language, I did occasionally insert a word. For example, the word for dawn in that language is dayclean. I think that's such a beautiful word.
It is lovely.
I use that. And the word for woodpecker was fulafafa. And I inserted those two words from the Gullah Geechee language just to give you a flavor of what it was like. I mean, it would have been very daunting for 21st centuries, black or white, to try to read that language as it's sometimes transcribed by linguists of the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm. But there is a continuing objection on the part of some African Americans, especially with a white author, to depict blacks saying things like "I'm a guana, do this," and "Yaza master," and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I did not do that. You will notice
you didn't do that. What happened to Zabette after Pierre married his white wife, Catherine Corb?
She stayed in the household until after her. After her father died, she still remained with her grandmother, and she was eventually sold by her grandmother to the wealthiest planter on Cumberland Island. Now, that's accurate, historically accurate, and I was very interested. One of the things that writers of historical fiction get to do that historians can't do is to delve into the crevices and to the emotions and to the responses and to the reasons things happen and the motivations. And I wondered why a grandmother who had raised this child herself would ever do such a thing. And I used the actual document in which she had sold her granddaughter to Robert Stafford. And it's curiously worded because it gives her the right to bring Zabette back if she needs to for any reason. And I tried to think through, if I was the grandmother of that child and I knew she had virtually no opportunities to find love on her own with a white man, and I, as grandmother, and I'm putting myself in the role of that grandmother, would not have any desire to see her marry into the quarters, to jump the broom, as you saw some of the earlier characters doing.
Right.
She seems to me to be looking for the best solution for this child.
I thought maybe she was figuring, I'm not going to live forever.
Exactly.
And after I die, she's got nobody. And someone has got to take care of her, make sure she's fed and housed. And you know, a slave owner would do that.
And if she kept the right to bring her back, to bring her home as long as she, the grandmother, lived, then she was protecting her from brutality or whatever he might inflict on this young girl.
So she felt she was doing her duty.
Well, that's how I interpreted it in the book. And, of course, one can always – history is interpretation.
Right.
And historical fiction also is interpretation. And I think you could read the grandmother a variety of ways, but I think this is – to me, this, as a grandmother, this is the most logical thing that I think she would have done.
We'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record in just a moment.
The Army ROTC College Program at MTSU prepares students mentally, physically, and emotionally to become leaders and promotes virtues of duty, honor, country. ROTC cadets are involved in all academic disciplines, athletics, and student organizations at MTSU. Full scholarships and tuition assistance are awarded based on merit. All cadets upon graduation will serve their country as second lieutenants either in the Army, Army Reserve, or Army National Guard. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. June Hall McCash is our guest. She's the author of Plum Orchard, which is a novel it's set in slave times in the United States, and it's set in the Cumberland Island, Jekyll Island area off the coast of Georgia. Why do you spell Jekyll Island in the book with one L instead of two?
Well, because Jekyll Island was spelled with one L until 1929. And the Jekyll Island Club requested that the state of Georgia correct the spelling. It was named for Sir Joseph Jekyll of England, who did spell his name with two L's, but it had always been spelled this way. And on Jekyll in Brunswick, which is just on the coast, Jekyll's right off the coast of Brunswick, Georgia, their saying went around, they doubled the L and they all went to, you know where.
Right.
I don't know if I can say that on the air, but they all, because it was 1929, and of course the stock market crashed that year, and it was the beginning of the Great Depression. And the people on Jekyll Island, of course, were multimillionaires.
Right.
And lost a great deal of money during that era.
Zabette found the physical accommodations in the white world inviting, but the white atmosphere didn't have much warmth or sweetness for her, did it?
Well, no. In my book, she really almost envies some of the camaraderie among the slaves. Not that anybody would ever envy their life.
Right.
But she goes, for example, she has a friend as a little girl. She grows up with a little friend in the slave quarters. And when the friend gets married or jumps the broom, as they did right. on the islands in those days, Zabette goes to the wedding. And she sees here they are for once in their lives, relaxed, enjoying themselves. Food has been sent by the white masters to the slave quarters, and everyone's enjoying themselves. And she sees this, and she goes back. There's no one there. There's no children to play with. She's a teenager by now, but she just doesn't share that kind of life. She's not invited to any of the parties at the white plantations. She's invited to this particular function only because her little friend is getting married. And, of course, that marriage will create a great separation in their lives. Ultimately,
did the African Americans reject Zabette because she was half white, or was it just that she had been raised white so she didn't feel like she fit in?
Well, I think that when one is raised in the big house, as they called it, there's a certain distancing, emotional distancing that they must have felt from her because she dressed like the European, like her French grandmother.
Yeah.
She behaved in that manner. I mean, that's the way she simply was raised. And she did not feel a connection or at home. She didn't. Perhaps it was because she didn't feel they accepted her. But on the other hand, I think there would have been a certain distancing. There is a scene in which there is a man who approaches her not knowing who she is. And the moment he finds out, or the moment he is informed that she's off limits, he backs away and she feels a sense of rejection mm-hmm. at that point. And of course, it's not her personally who's being rejected, but it's the fact that she is not one of them, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting how with all of these complex, violent, and socioeconomic oppressions, that still tiny little threads of love slip through and cross the lines. Pierre had love for Zabette, and Zabette had love for him. The grandmother had love for Zabette, and Zabette had love for her. Catherine's kind of a cold fish. But despite everything, there is still a different, even if it's a different definition of love than what you and I think about, there is some definition of love there. How did you manage to make sure that slipped through all of the hatred and suspicion and terror?
Well, I think love is a natural part of human life, no matter who you are, no matter what color your skin is, no matter what gender you are. I think that love is a common factor among all people. We don't all love each other, that's true. But there, just because one was white and one was black doesn't mean there couldn't be some affection. I realize that there's always that power position of the slaveholder with the slave. But I think of, for example, of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Sally Hemings was his wife's sister. His wife had promised on her deathbed, had made him promise never to marry again. She must have resembled his wife to some extent. I don't doubt that there was true affection between them. And he fathered at least one and probably more of her children, as we know now, thanks to DNA. Vaughn Brody was a historian who brought this to the forefront years ago and was kind of not taken too seriously. But now we know that there is certainly Jefferson blood in the Hemings children. And I think that love does not see those same barriers. And this is a theme that runs through literature from Romeo and Juliet and long before up to the present day, that barriers, just because they're social barriers, just because they're racial barriers, doesn't mean that we can't love someone who's different from us.
It even runs through 20th century history. If we remember the African-American daughter of Strom Thurmond, who just passed away recently.
Absolutely. And she apparently maintained some affection for her father. Hard to understand sometimes, but I mean, he evidently, despite his overt political stance, apparently showed her affection throughout her life.
We'll be right back after one more quick break on MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee Writing Project is a program that fosters the effective teaching of writing to students in kindergarten through high school. The project hosts annual summer institutes where teacher participants teach and learn from each other effective techniques of teaching writing. In addition, the project sponsors summer writers' camps for youngsters. MTSU is one of 185 sites of the National Writing Project and one of only two in Tennessee. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the novel Plum Orchard, and the author is Dr. June Hall McCash, the former head of the Honors Program and professor in the College of Foreign Languages and Literatures, former professor. You've got three books all sort of coming to promotional culmination at the same time here. You've got your co-write, you have co-written one with your son, and you've got Plum Orchard nominated for an award, and you've got Titanic nominated for an award.
Right. Well, it just kind of happened. It doesn't mean that I suddenly wrote three books in 1 year.
No.
I could just never do that, and I spend a lot of time. I'd been working on a Titanic love story, Ida and Isidore Strauss, for about 10 years. And I finally decided that 2011 was the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the, I'm sorry, 2012 mm-hmm. was the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. If I was ever going to finish it, I had to have it ready by mm-hmm. that time. So that was published in March. Plum Orchard came out in January. And then the book I did with my son, who is a professor here at MTSU, Dr. Bren Martin, was done over a period of probably a year and a half. He and I were commissioned to do this book by the Jekyll Island Club Hotel, and it's a celebratory book for their 25th anniversary following their restoration of the club hotel.
When you read the prose in Plum Orchard, then if you've never been there, you can certainly let your mind do the rest. Dr. June Hall McCash, author of Plum Orchard and many other books. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Jenna.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.